San Francisco has violated all underwriting traditions and precedent by not burning up. So said the National Board of Fire Underwriters in October of 1905. San Francisco would soon oblige them. An earthquake the following April ignited fires that leveled the city and raised issues that face us still in other cities and other catastrophes.
Whose ground zero is this? New York City is conflicted about it, but you have to make tough decisions.
Never in the history of the world has a city been emptied by gunpoint, a whole city. This was an enormous social experiment, and that is what has devastated New Orleans.
Three cities, three disasters, separated by a century, joined by common concerns. This program explores the aftermath of these events, looking for lessons learned and lessons lost. This is The City Will Rise. Hello, I'm Mary Alice Williams. Welcome to The City Will Rise. Years ago, on the night of April 17th, 1906, the great tenor Enrico Caruso made his first and only appearance in San Francisco. The event was a brilliant jewel in the city's crown, the Queen of the West hosting the world's finest singer in the world's most popular opera, Bizet's Carmen. But the next day, no one was speaking of Caruso. Most people were not speaking at all. They were wandering in stunned silence, or desperately searching or clawing out of rubble. That morning, just before sunrise, the earth shrugged, and San Francisco collapsed and burned.
I had heard in the morning of the earthquake that the Valencia Hotel on Valencia Street had collapsed. So I got up there as quick as I could, and several blocks, and I helped pull the dead and the crippled people out.
I remember my dad taking me across the street that evening, and we watched the town burn. We were up on Buchanan Street between Herman and Waller, and we could see these flash fires breaking out all over the city, you know. And even, for a little fellow 3 years old, it was just a gorgeous sight. I didn't realize what was taking place down there. It was spectacular to me, you know, but I remember it was a vivid picture.
San Francisco burned out of control for 3 days after the earthquake. The destruction is preserved in photographs. Cameras were becoming commonplace by that time, and the calamity was recorded more thoroughly than any in previous history. The photographs reveal a landscape of devastation, a foreshadowing of Dresden and Hiroshima. Dennis Smith is chairman of First Responders Financial. He's a former New York City firefighter and the author of San Francisco is Burning.
28,000 buildings burned in the fires that were caused by the earthquakes. Why did the earthquakes cause the fire? Well, because flues were connected to the roofs, and the earthquakes displaced many of the flues, and the heat from the fires, instead of going out, went to the roofs of the buildings and created fires. That's one reason. Another reason is all those morning fires that were created to heat things. Like in a Chinese laundry, those fires created to heat the iron so that the laundry people could work, ironing sheets and pillowcases and so on, or to put a breakfast on or whatever. Those fires became displaced.
The city now resembled a vast holocaust. I ascended a hill at one side from which I had a view over the scene. This was the foreign quarter, and the hill was an encampment mostly of Spaniards and Italians, all over the slopes, suggestive of a battlefield. Again, it was a lovely day, the sun shining on the hills and the bay in all directions, whilst below, and as far as the eye could reach over the city, nothing but fire, and the same pall of black smoke. The same continuous roar, carried by the dynamite explosives of the military, trying to stem the progress of the flames. Line after line of houses bursting into flames, and then falling with a crash. Then again, fresh fires appeared in outside places, and in each case, nothing to stop them, for there was no water, and the military could not be everywhere, and were concentrating their efforts in the most important parts of the city. But as it subsequently proved, all to no purpose. William Hancock, in a letter to his wife, Mary, May the 31st, 1906.
The building's collapsing.
I heard an explosion while I was brushing my teeth, and my mother-in-law was there to take care of my daughter for the day because 5 days later she was going into the daycare center in the World Trade Center.
On the morning of September 11th, 2001, Bree Matsuoka was at home in Battery Park City. Her floor-to-ceiling windows looked directly out onto the site that would become known as Ground Zero.
I ran out and we saw that something had hit the World Trade Center, and we watched from that point on, held my baby and watched what was going on. I actually also videotaped a lot of it.
Oh my God!
Oh my God! I know now when people are in the midst of the catastrophe, it is very different from what you see on television, what you read in the paper. It is much worse when you're right there. We were watching humans in such states of distress like I've never seen. People running away and people's lives strewn all over the ground, all over the trees and the grass, on top of cars, on top of buildings. Nothing like you could ever imagine. It was just horrendous. And so in one way, what I have a connection in a small way to other people who go through catastrophe, and that I know what they are experiencing is a million times worse than anything that anybody's seeing or reading or hearing.
There is a very thin membrane that separates savagery from civilization. And once again, I saw it break. But I think this was the worst example in my own country, in my own city, that I've ever seen in my life. And that includes experiences in jails in Guatemala and the Cultural Revolution in China and coup d'etat in Spain.
James Nolan is a writer, poet, essayist, and translator. He's a fifth-generation native of New Orleans. He lives in a 200-year-old townhouse in the French Quarter. That's where he rode out Hurricane Katrina last August, with no significant damage. Then the levees gave way. The city flooded, and eventually he was forced to evacuate.
All of the social problems that really had a lid on them, the lid just boiled over. So there were gangs of kids from the projects armed with rifles and machine guns circulating on bicycles. I constantly heard the tinkle of broken glass from looting. And because of the forced evacuation, the city emptied. So there was no civic presence to hold things together. My feeling of the city now is that it's completely paralyzed. I cannot believe that, we had a hurricane 5 months ago. We have no mail service. Two-thirds of the city is without lights. Two-thirds of the residents are not here. Major hospitals have closed. Most schools have closed. The city is absolutely paralyzed in terms of any kind of recovery. It has to do with the resilience of the people. It has to do with the independence of the people and the community spirit of the people, all of which we have. But I think it was broken by the way the hurricane was handled. I'm sure in San Francisco, because in 1906 it had such an identity as a cosmopolitan city, that there was no doubt that people were going to stay and rebuild San Francisco.
San Francisco will rise from the ashes. A greater and more beautiful city than ever. Vast loan is offered. Business firms prepare to adorn the city with stately buildings. Realty men sanguine. Future is bright for San Francisco. Great city will soon rise.
Headlines from San Francisco newspapers read by Philip Fradkin. He collected them for his book, The Great Earthquake and Firestorms of 1906. And while the newspapers had their facts a little sideways, their blazing optimism was pretty much justified. The city did rise, almost completely destroyed by the disaster. San Francisco was back in business in 3 years, largely rebuilt in less than 10.
Mm-hmm.
By 1906, San Francisco had a lot of practice rebuilding itself. As it grew in the years after the gold rush of 1849, the city burned down six times, and every time it rose again, much as it had been, only bigger. The more it burned, the more people came. The city's flag proudly displayed a phoenix rising from flames. Two damaging earthquakes in the 1860s didn't discourage anyone either. So in the aftermath of the 06 catastrophe, San Francisco was just doing what it had always done. And, says State Librarian Emeritus Kevin Starr, what it still does.
Even after we developed a scientific knowledge of our vulnerability in California, our vulnerability to earthquake, fire, flood, and drought, even after we acknowledge these things, we go into a mode of suppression. It's part of our cultural construct to suppress those things. They're suppressed by us day by day. We're here in San Francisco now, right nearby a fault, and there's 800,000 people out there right now who aren't too worried about it. And yet at the same time, all the probabilities show us that the earthquake of significant magnitude will come. And I think that's what happened after April 1906. We almost went into denial immediately. Even in the reports that were made just a few weeks later after the earthquake, things were suppressed. And by the time we got, say, a year or two or three out from the earthquake, we had almost had suppressed the idea that earthquakes ever happened in California, much less the one of April 1906.
Today, you may not speak in San Francisco of the earthquake. You'll be instantly corrected. It was the fire that did the damage, you'll be told, and photographs will be shown you, taken the morning of the shock, which will prove the assertion. Then the citizen, with a Californian's pride in the many superlative possessions of his state, will probably inform you that it is the greatest disaster in history. But, he will add, in 10 years you will not be able to find a trace of the ruins. San Francisco will be a better built, more prosperous, more beautiful city than it was. Instead of 400,000 population, we'll have 700,000. French Strother, The Rebound of San Francisco, in The World's Work magazine, July 1906.
See, this is a record of interments, Laurel Hill Cemetery.
This is Gladys Hansen. She's the Archivist Emeritus of San Francisco, curator of the Museum of the City of San Francisco, and co-author of the book Denial of Disaster. She's looking through an undertaker's death records from a century ago.
Take a look here. G. Kin, China. Harry Chesbrough. Unknown body, unknown Chinaman.
Gladys Hansen's been searching through records like these for a long time, ever since she received some inquiries related to the 1906 disaster about 40 years ago.
This whole thing started with requests by genealogists. Gladys, do you have a list of those that died in 1906? Because they were searching for lost family members that were here. And no, I couldn't find such a list, so I assumed it was going to be only 478 people, believing our supervisors. And that seemed easy to do from the newspapers.
In the wake of the earthquake and fire, San Francisco's Board of Supervisors had listed 478 as the official death toll, a figure that had stood unchallenged for 60 years when Gladys Hansen began her investigations. She immediately discovered that something was wrong.
In my first run, I had 503 people. So already I'd gone over. So once you get sparked, you want to keep going. And so I requested through mail to genealogical and historical societies advertising what I was doing. And then I kind of sat back and waited, hoping that somebody would see it and help me. Whoa, the mail came in. And it is still coming in.
Part of it is the absolute anonymity of it. It always bothered me that there was nothing left of him. You know, everybody else, they have a grave, they have a marker, they have something.
That's Kathleen Lawton, a Bay Area radio host. She wrote one of those letters to Gladys Hansen. Kathleen was searching for a relative she'd never met. He was known in her family as Uncle Willie, the younger brother of Kathleen's grandmother. like countless thousands of others, William Roberts, Uncle Willie, had come to America from Ireland around the turn of the century. He settled in Seattle with his mother, sister, and her family. Then, in April of 1906, he traveled to San Francisco looking for work. He was there, probably staying in a cheap rooming house south of Market Street, when the earthquake struck.
And I think it's the nature of that kind of a death, partly that the person vanished, partly that the person was very young, you know, and it's just so sad that he would come all the way over here and make a start in a new world with his only sister, and then he vanished off the face of the earth.
I always thought, I was very young and naive when I started this project, that we could believe our board of supervisors. I don't believe them anymore because they were way off on this.
Gladys Hansen's research led to a drastic revision of the 1906 death toll. By her conservative estimate, at least 3,000 people lost their lives. In her book, Denial of Disaster, and in subsequent books by other historians and researchers, it's clear that the death toll was just part of the untold story.
Wait a minute, what do you think I'm running here, a funeral parlor? Give it this. Put something into it, heat it up. That's what it's about, San Francisco.
Oh, but I can't sing like that, Mr. Norton.
Well, that's the way you're going to sing, or you're not going to sing it for Blackie.
The movie, of course, is called San Francisco. It had Jeanette MacDonald and Clark Gable. I think I saw it when I was about 10 years old.
Like James Nolan in New Orleans, James Haas is a fifth-generation native San Franciscan. He's also a lawyer and author of a recent research paper on the rebuilding of the city.
The movie set a kind of standard, but if you go back to the early days, you know that the Chamber of Commerce and others tried to play down the nature of the disaster. So I think, you know, the orthodoxy of the earthquake was it wasn't that big deal, and everybody got together and worked hard and solved all their problems and sang songs and so forth. But, you know, if you have a community that has lots of divisions, those divisions are going to transcend the disaster.
A 1907 photo montage titled Heroes of the Great Calamity pictures nearly 500 people. Most of them are firemen, soldiers, and policemen. Two of the most prominent photos depict San Francisco's mayor, Eugene Schmitz, and Major General Frederick Funston. By the time the poster was published, Schmitz had been forced out of office, accused of graft and corruption, but he went down in history as a hero of the disaster for rising to the occasion, making quick and bold decisions. Among the first of these was this order, posted throughout the city only hours after the earthquake struck.
Proclamation by the mayor. The federal troops, the members of the regular police force, and all special police officers have been authorized by me to kill any and all persons found engaged in looting or in the commission of any other crime.
Press reports at the time credited Schmitz's order with saving the city from looters, thieves, and scoundrels. But in letters to friends and relatives, people sometimes told a different story.
What a night. We felt that if we got home here alive again, we'd stay here, for no lights of any kind are on in the houses, and they take a shot at you if you're out after 8:30 p.m. So you sit in pitch darkness with a gloomy pall of smoke over your heads and a graveyard silence and an occasional earthquake tremor. We never closed our eyes that night, and it began to rain, and a cold, mournful wind began to howl around open chimney holes and busted roofs. At 5 o'clock, a rifle shot was heard on the block, and some young fellow fell dead who was misprudent enough to venture out to borrow some whiskey for his sick mother. A soldier ordered him to throw it away and shot him for refusing. This is only one of many cases. Frederick Collins, writing to his family from San Francisco, April 24th, 1906.
There's no way to know if Mr. Collins actually saw what he reported in his letter, or if he was just relaying a story he had heard. The air in San Francisco was as thick with rumors as it was with smoke. But what is known is this.
Mayor Schmitz had no authority to issue such an order. It was completely illegal and without precedent in the United States. To enforce the proclamation, Schmitz authorized Major General Funston, who was acting commander of the U.S. Army's Pacific Division, to send federal troops into the city. San Francisco's fire chief, Dennis Sullivan, had been mortally injured in the first seconds of the earthquake. There was no one to take his place, so Mayor Schmitz also turned to General Funston to direct firefighting efforts. Again, Dennis Smith, author of San Francisco is Burning.
Funston then brought his soldiers into the city with fixed bayonets. Now, why did he do that? Because Funston came out of the Philippine War. He was a great hero. He won the Medal of Honor. He was a man who brought the military perception and bearing to an emergency situation that needed mitigation. It did not need containment. It needed mitigation. There's a huge difference. And the military personality brought containment. He said, surround the city, make sure that there is calm in the city and no looting, and we will be in control, and the firemen will do their job. Well, he brought 1,700 troops in with fixed bayonets. And then he took a police force of 600 police officers and sent them around closing all the bars in the early stages of this fire. When anyone with any sense of how fire works, what the nature of fire is and how it spreads, would know that the best thing to do is to start using this manpower if you don't have any water and start at the very least taking stuff, things, furniture, paper, out of these buildings so that you will reduce the fire load. You can reduce, 50% of the fire load if you empty the building out.
As the city's earthquake-damaged water supply dwindled, General Funston ordered his troops to dynamite blocks of buildings to create fire breaks. But neither the general nor his soldiers had any experience doing it. Here again is Philip Fradkin, author of The Great Earthquake and Firestorms of 1906.
There were a lot of explosives in the Bay Area because the Spanish-American War had just ended. The troops had come back from the Philippines. There was a lot of mining in the Sierra Nevada. So the first thing they thought of was explosives, which wasn't a bad choice, only they chose the wrong explosives. They chose gunpowder, black powder, similar type of explosives that just amplified the flames once they were exploded.
In addition to dynamiting blocks of buildings and enforcing the shoot-to-kill decree, Funston's troops were ordered to evacuate civilians. Again, Dennis Smith.
They had, at my count, about 4,000 people ready, able, and willing to work. I have many photographs where these fires are burning and there are hundreds of men standing with their hands in their pockets watching these fires burn, being kept out of the area by soldiers with bayonets because they had forced evacuations. Every single incident where people circumnavigated the soldiers and went back to their homes, at least the incidents that we know of, they saved their homes and their properties. Every incident where they were forced out of their homes and not allowed back, their property was lost. This is really a great man, General Funston, and I'm very careful to say that he was an American hero, and we cannot forget that. He made terrible, ruinous decisions that day, and he was allowed to make them by essentially an acquiescing mayor and a fire department that had no real leadership. And this is what caused the great San Francisco catastrophe.
When we return...
The fire's out!
Come on,
out!
The fire's out!
I'm Mary Alice Williams. This is The City Will Rise.